This is an ABC podcast.
I look forward to leading a government that makes Australians proud.
This election didn't just change a government, it was a green slide.
Safe Liberal seat, two-term incumbent, independent.
We need to go back to our values, our principles, look closely at what has happened.
Our policies will be squarely aimed at the forgotten Australians in the suburbs across regional Australia.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and we're joining you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people. And in the studio with me is
Fran Kelly. Also here happily on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people in the studio, even more happily with you, PK.
Super happy in Parliament House.
And soon there's going to be a crowded little studio because Phil Khoury, Chief Political Correspondent with the Australian Financial Review, will join us here in this little room. First though, PK, the 47th Parliament is off and racing. And actually, I think that's a pretty good description of how it's been this week. The new PM has said, you know, I'm not going to waste a day. And he's unleashed 18 pieces of legislation this first sitting week. What can we say about this new government? You've had a ringside seat here in Parliament all week. If we just look at the first bills off the rank, I think the first one was aged care.
Yeah, I think it says everything about the priorities of this new government. So it sought to really focus its attention on some core Labor issues, including the treatment of the elderly and taking action, for instance, after the Royal Commission, saying that the previous government had not done enough on the Aged Care Royal Commission's recommendations. And so to prioritise that is a signal. Also, 10 days of domestic violence leave for any Australian suffering it, but it is, as we know, because of gender-based violence, disproportionately women. So that's another element, getting rid of the cashless welfare card and the big one, of course, the climate change legislation. These are all signature issues of this government. And yes, you're right, I've had a ringside, front row seat as journalists love to have, and I've got to see just the focus of the new government. It is a busy agenda. Obviously, they love to tell us it's 18 pieces of legislation to paint a picture of a very busy administration that's very serious about what it
wants
to do.
Getting on with running the country.
That's right.
I mean, because that was a constant criticism of the Morrison government, was that they had an empty agenda, really. Mm. It was a suggestion they had so few sitting weeks last year because they basically had not much to do.
Well, it's true. Before the 2019 election, if we could go a little into history, there wasn't much of an agenda. It was the big criticism. And then the pandemic hit and that kept them very busy.
Yeah.
But it was very much in that emergency management mode. This government has got all these plans and we've known about them. They were promises in the election. And so this week has been about prioritising them and framing the debate around their issues. I think it's been actually quite a good week for the new government. I mean, you'd expect that. They're still in the honeymoon period. That's how they describe it, even privately to me. They know that. But still, it's been a good week. They're facing, though, a huge set of tasks, which we're going to get into. Let's talk about the 43% emissions reduction target by 2030. The government introduced this bill into the lower house on Wednesday and will probably have a vote on that next week. They want to get it through the lower house. Then it goes, obviously, to the Senate process. They did alter it to include some suggestions from their good faith, as they described them, discussions with the crossbench, mainly the Greens, who have a huge stake in crucial votes because, as Chris Bowen describes, the coalition has dealt themselves out of this. And I think he's right on that. And he's also kind of opened up making more explicit the target that was a flaw, not a ceiling. So, I actually think it's kind of minor change, to be honest. But either way, making it more explicit that you can ratchet it up in the future. And Chris Bowen even flagged more ambitious 2035 target, including trying to go further. He says they're never going to go lower. It's always about going further. So some small concessions, but not on the big things.
Yeah, some small concessions, but concessions in a bill that actually didn't do much. They didn't need it. So they made some concessions and made things clearer. I think that's good. The crossbench and the Greens nailing the government's feet to the floor a bit on it. It was really interesting, I thought, to see the Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen and the Greens leader Adam Bank get down to business as an indicator of how this key relationship really with the Greens might develop in this parliament. Both started out drawing their own lines in the sand. In the end, Chris Bowen started to sound a little more conciliatory, talking about sensible adjustments, certainly sounding more conciliatory than his leader. Anthony Albanese, of course, some describe him as a Greens hater. So this is going to be interesting to watch this relationship. But then, the big shift came when the Greens leader came under a fair bit of pressure from a swag of environmental groups. He came out and praised the government for agreeing to some changes. And when asked if his his toughest demand of no new coal and gas projects, you know, were they a deal breaker? That was the shift. He said they're not a deal breaker. And that was really the shift that signalled Labor had done enough to get the bill through the Parliament and through the Senate. Although, as you've said, that Senate vote won't happen till the processes go through. That'll probably be September. A month is a long time in politics.
Oh, it's such a long time in politics. So I'm not calling it done and dusted because that would be crazy. But I do think it's moving in the right direction in terms of consensus in some place where the Greens continue to kind of make their points. It's not ambitious enough. But ultimately, I can't see them voting against it at this stage based on the rhetoric that we've heard, including this, because I asked Adam Bandt on RM Breakfast this week if the government's refusal to include the measure to create a moratorium on new gas and coal projects would be, you know, the deal breaker, as you just mentioned. This was his answer.
Look, we're not approaching this discussion with ultimatums. We're happy to put everything on the table and we'll continue to have those discussions in good faith.
So that's the Greens leader, Fran. While this could be a point of contention, it does seem the Greens are still open to supporting the legislation while also using it as a political point that they will continue to prosecute, to be clear, post this vote.
Yeah, I mean, in their mind, politically, perhaps they've come to the conclusion that they win both ways in the sense that they're taking this strong stand publicly, that they want more and that Labor's, you know, sending cross messages. How can you look at decarbonising the environment and lowering emissions while you're still allowing new gas and coal? So that's the broadcast message that they'll take right through to the election campaign. Adam Bandt obviously hoping the Greens can build on what he calls the green slide of the last election, maybe steal some more votes away from Labor next time, but at the same time not putting themselves in the position where they've really paid a pretty heavy price for since 2009 when they sided with the opposition and voted down the CPRS. As I mentioned, we've got these environment groups coming out and saying, don't do that this time. We've lost too many years to that. The climate wars were unleashed from that point. They've never calmed. This is the chance. I think they've heard that message. You mentioned Peter Dutton and the opposition dealing themselves out of the game, which is a strange position to take, you would think, so definitively, given the clobbering they got in those inner city seats in Melbourne and Sydney that from the Teals independents and Perth, you know, largely over climate. Why did they do this? It's still not clear to me where the votes are that they're going to pick up through this. And I thought it was interesting that Liberal MP Bridget Archer, one of the few moderates left in that party room after the last election, made it clear to you, I think, PK, on RM Breakfast this week, that she is basically bound for crossing the floor. The Libs, they still haven't discussed in the party room, but they all seem to be gathering, apart from Bridget Archer, behind their leader.
And Senator Andrew Bragg came on RM Breakfast. We're recording this on Thursday morning too. I'm talking about the Senate committee that will be looking at the bill and saying he wanted to, you know, look at the economic evidence. But really, what he's signalling is, firstly, he reserves his right to cross the floor in the Senate still.
Yeah.
And also,
well, they all have that right, so that's not that courageous.
But he's saying it.
Yeah.
And also that he will try and use this report to try and pressure his own side, that there is an economic case for doing this.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting too, a sort of a sense from him that he would like business to carry the case more loudly. In other words, come on business, get on board, get behind this, and then it'll be harder for the Liberal Party to vote against it. But we'll see. Peter Dutton has been absolutely definitive.
That's right, and he's got the numbers in the party room, and the party room has changed after the loss of many moderates.
And PK, you mentioned some of the bills that the government's bringing in or has brought in, and that says something about their agenda and about their values and that they want to project as the kind of government they'll be. But Anthony Albanese made much of, before the election and since being elected, of a new kind of politics. And he had to do that in a sense after election night because he got delivered a big fat crossbench in the lower house and quite a big fat crossbench in the Senate as well. So there's going to be more collaboration needed. But are you seeing signs of a different kind of politics? I notice they keep talking about being the adults in the room. What do you reckon?
They like being called the adults in the room. And they use the language again to contrast from the previous government. Interestingly, first question time that I went to, so I can make a judgment on that. Look, it didn't look that different to the last question times in terms of, you know, government MPs, front benches getting up, spruiking their own policy and then bagging the opposition. That was what we used to hear. There was a few differences. You get three questions from the crossbench rather than the one. Okay, that's a difference. So far, we've only had the sort of old crossbenches, like Bob Catter asked questions that we haven't hasn't seen the new ones yet, but they will. They'll get their turn. That's how it works. The tone was, well, I was underwhelmed, I'll be honest.
I was underwhelmed.
I don't entirely blame the government. I blame kind of, well, everyone. I mean, I just think politics sounded a little bit like it always has.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure that's what Anthony Albanese was talking about when he said it was going to be a new kind of politics. I think it was more the collaboration he's talking about. And as I say, that's been sort of forced upon him, really, because of how the parliament looks. But yeah, I was sitting watching Question Time from home, as you do. And particularly when the Dorothy Dixers, they all stood up and said, you know, what's the policy or some, you know, it sounded snoozy. It didn't sound dynamic. It didn't sound that electric to me. And then, of course, we get into the sledging. That's perhaps no surprise, but we'll see. It's early days.
Very early. It's infancy, this new parliament. Should we bring our guest in?
Let's do it.
Phil Currie is Chief Political Correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. Welcome to the party room.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
Phil, so good to be squashed in here with you all. Phil, PK and I were just talking about the approach of this new parliament. The Albanese government keep saying they're going to do politics differently. You know, we're the adults in the room, we're the grown-ups. You, like PK, have been in Question Time. You've watched a close-up. You've seen a lot of new governments. Did you notice anything different?
No, not one thing. No,
not one thing?
No, only the bemused expressions on the new people, especially the Teals going, you know, what have we done? You know, how we can do this? No, look, as I've said many times, you know, things should always be civil, but but this place is always going to be combative. And you can sort of tell from, you know, the first Question Time that the Libs aren't going to sort of sit there and feel sorry for themselves. They're going to sort of come out swinging, and Labor's ready for that. But it's going to be every bit as combative as it was, you know, before. I mean, the thing I really noticed, there's this wonderful moment on Tuesday when they were doing the swearing in. I don't know if you saw it, but when all the Teals were sworn in, so they came up to the, and there was eight independents, and they were all women. You know, as Monique Ryan.
I was watching on the TV. Yeah. It was fabulous imagery.
Yeah,
really.
But it was this wonderful moment because I was sitting just above the speaker's head and they were beaming. You know, their eyes were, they all had masks on, but they were all looking at each other going, how good is this? You know, and it was just this wonderful moment of sort of purity that, you know, sort of reminds you that people still come into this building for the right reasons.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
They were so excited and proud of themselves. But then straight afterwards, we went into the election of the speaker and, and there was this complete charade about why Milton Dick was the speaker. Now, Milton's a good guy and he's going to be a good speaker.
So far, so good, actually.
So far, so good. I thought.
But the reason Milton Dick was the speaker was because it was a deal done in the right? It was nothing to do with merit, right? Yeah. But then the parliament goes through this whole charade about, you know, his dad was in the Navy and no, why he should be speaker. And I was just thinking, nothing ever changes, you know, it's just a factional deal.
It is always arithmetic.
It was a nice juxtaposition, I thought, yeah.
Yeah, so look, you know, huge crossbench, as we say, questions from the crossbench, for instance. There are
That's a good move.
They have to do it proportionally. They rode more, so it's just, yeah.
And they've had meetings with the crossbench where
they've appreciated.
They've been bringing them in a bit, right?
Look, there's a much better vibe around. I think there's a sense of excitement I haven't seen with the new. If there's anything different, there's a lot more diversity around the building. You know, not
holy
just,
dooly,
yeah,
yes.
Not just gender, but also ethnicity.
Yes,
and stuff.
Absolutely.
It's actually starting to look a bit more like a slice of society than this sort of all white male female thing. So it just feels a bit more ebullient and vibrant.
Well, you can see it on the television too. If you look at Labor's crossbench, you can see it writ large.
Cross bench, Labor.
And Albanese's no dill, and he knows he needs to sort of foster that and that goodwill, and even though he doesn't need the independent numerically, it's in his interest politically to keep the Teals in those seats, because the longer they're there, he stays in government.
Hard to get a majority without those seats.
Exactly. So you can see it on the climate change bill. They're going to talk to them. They're consulting them on the Integrity Commission. All the issues on which they campaigned, he's giving them a sense of ownership, even though he doesn't need to. So they can go back to the electorate and say, I contributed to this, and that's clever politics, but it also will sort of engender that sort of, that mood he's trying to get around the building.
A more collaborative style. Mm. A lot that's not different. All the sledging continued in Question Time. Yeah. Peter Dutton, opposition leader, nailed his colours to the mast early on, you know, taking a stand against Labor's 43% target. They're not going to vote for that bill. The PK and I have been talking about, they've dealt themselves out of that. Mm. What can we tell so far at this early stage about the Dutton opposition and the messages and the lessons they've taken from the election loss?
Well, I think there's a couple of lessons they haven't taken. And I think the main one is they haven't showed any contrition since they lost. They haven't come out and said we got some things wrong. I know the government thinks that's a big mistake. When you get hounded out of government the way they did, you should come out and say, look, we're going to heed the lessons of this. There's been none of that. So it's a very sort of defiant style from Dutton.
It's really odd.
Yeah. Now, I'm not underestimating anyone. A lot of people underestimated Anthony Albanese. Didn't think he'd become prime
minister. I wouldn't underestimate Peter Dutton.
I'm not underestimating, but he's a very good political operative, Dutton. Even the moderates who have their noses out of joint about what he did on climate by making that unilateral decision before, you know, having a party room meeting, they quite like him. They're quite happy with the direction. I spoke to some people who were veterans of when they last lost government in 2007, and they said it feels a lot, because back then it was this miserable sort of wallowing, and you had Brendan Nielsen became leader and Turnbull immediately started undermining him, and it was just 18 months of horror. But they said there's none of that this time. There's at least a clarity about things, whether you agree with it or not.
So there's also no alternative.
That's right. Well, that's a consequence of that. But you had Josh Frydenberg kept his seat. Have they learned their lesson?
Well, have they learned their lesson? I mean, let's look at evidence-based. Mm. They've got some evidence. They had some evidence delivered to them.
You've
been writing this, you know, about a post-mortem, what the data shows. What does it show, and what are they taking out of that?
I think, to his credit, they had a big all-day seminar on Monday, all the Liberal MPs, and they had John Howard and Tony Abbott and Amanda Vanstone address them in the afternoon, and they were going to get Helen McCabe, former Women's Weekly editor, in, but she got COVID. So he was, let's talk about women, let's talk about how we pick ourselves up, let's not wallow in defeat. But in the morning, both Andrew Hirst, the federal director, and Tony Barry's deputy director in Victoria, now works with Redbridge Polling, they lock about a 3-hour session in the morning where they ran through focus group polling and stuff like that. And no surprise, it basically found that the Liberal Party has lost a lot of its base. What happened at the last election, that basically people under 50 or 60 just don't connect with it in terms of values and concerns.
People or women?
All sorts.
Broad, right?
Broad. I mean, predominantly women, obviously. I didn't see a gender breakdown, but you can tell. I think the women thing of the election was more about Scott Morrison than the Liberal Party as such. And, you know, issues like climate change and, you know, the renters have left them. And Tim Wilson raised this in his book. He wrote a good book, Tim Wilson, a couple of years ago when he said we've got to get rid of some of these taxes, like capital gains tax exemptions, because he said the Liberals' conservative base are homeowners and with fewer people owning homes. And this came up in this research, you know, that conservatives don't feel conservative when they have nothing to conserve. So there's these demographic shifts which are also sort of pulling voters away from the Labor Party.
That Redbridge work is really key because, it shows, for instance, in seats like Higgins, like massive kind of apartments that have been built
Kooyong.
All those people are renters.
Yeah, exactly.
And they are
renters.
Grumpy.
And they're not voting conservative. The interesting thing about the research too is there's also a lot of warnings there for Labor too, you know, in terms of the major parties. Remember, they only got 32.5% on election day and it just happened to fall in the right seat. So there's a lot in there about the threats from the Teals. It's not going to be a one-off sort of thing, you know, movement. They're very sophisticated movement. They understand what they're doing. They're organised. So, you know, sort of troubles ahead for both major parties, but, you know, more so for the one that's in opposition in terms of clawing their way back.
Now let's move to the big economic statement that will be delivered. We're recording this Thursday morning. It will be delivered officially very shortly and people will know about it by the time they listen to this podcast. But on the broader themes, inflation rose by 6.1% on Wednesday, which is the highest level in 21 years. I don't have to tell people that. They know because they shop. They have to feed their children. You know. It's alarming, actually. Like, just two items and you're like, what?
$20. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. In fact, it hasn't been that high since the GST was introduced. Here's what the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, had to say off the back of the rise.
So these are confronting numbers when it comes to the cost of living pressures that Australians in every corner of our country are feeling. Inflation is high and rising. It will get tougher before it starts to ease.
Now, we've heard a fair bit of that from the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, since the election. We're going to hear more of it over the next little while. You know, talking about the increasing strain off the back of rising inflation. Phil, the Treasurer's approach to economic challenges has been to be open about the difficulties people are facing. The Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor, says, well, he's got to do more than paint a picture of despair and hardship. Yes. He's got to come up with a plan. Fair point. But timing is everything in politics. Yes. How do you think the new Treasurer's pitch is working for the government?
Look, I think it's, because he's so articulate, Jim, I think it's working, but I think Angus Taylor also has a point. There's a time limit on being a doomsayer in terms of forecasting what they're going to do about it, especially as they were so critical before the election of the former government about all the things they were blaming them for. They're now saying this is beyond our control. So
it's still kind of jarring when I hear it because, of course, just tell me not that many weeks ago, you know, the other lot were, it was their economy and these were their problems. So it's still jarring, but I think you're right. Yeah. I think it will bite the plan.
Yeah, that sort of begins with the budget in October. As you said, Fran, timing is everything. And they're building to a process here. So what they're doing, they're saying, look, it's worse than we thought. And they are correct in terms of inflation was only meant to be 4.25%. Mm. That was the last prediction.
That's going to be north of seven, you said.
Yeah, it'd be about 8 or something today. So they've got to create the situation. Then they're going to have a budget in October where they're going to fund all their election promises and nothing more. And they're going to find more cuts than they promised they would. It's not just the rorts, but they're looking at manufacturing grants and some of these Morrison programs. But then more importantly, next year, they're going to do another intergenerational report. And that's that thing that's only meant to come out every 5 years. And it looks 40 years ahead in terms of what things cost. They're going to, there's only one a year ago. They're going to do another one. And that's going to be the real scary one, you know, massive debt deficit, the cost of social programs. Then there'll be a budget in May. And what he's building up to is taking mean stuff to the next election, right? So they're gonna
cutting statutory tax cuts.
Well, they might. I reckon that's a 50-50 proposition where they go ahead. But again, that's a decision you don't need to make now because they don't start for 2 years.
Which is what he said when the Greens leader asked him in
all these people saying spend the money now. Well, the money's not going to be spent for 2 years. Yeah. So it's a.
Do you think it's a 50-50 proposition?
I don't know. I think it's hard to.
This case keeps building.
We're broke, and it'll depend on the economic circuit. It's a big promise to break, though.
That's what I think.
And you've got to remember too, those tax cuts start at $40,000. You know, yeah. Adam Bant runs around saying it's for Clive Palmer.
But you can ameliorate it, right?
Yeah, just cap it or do whatever. And Labor looked at capping it when they were in opposition when they were trying to amend it. Mm. So I just think if they go through in their current state, I don't think it's a full guarantee. But I think it's more things like wealth. Yeah, you know, they're going to come after super taxes again. Yeah, you know, they won't do franking credits again. But they're going to look at those tax perks. You know, I think they're just going to have to. And Chalmers indicated this in an interview he did with us about 6 weeks ago. So I think this, what we're seeing today, is the start of a process towards fixing the budget.
He's building a case.
Yeah,
he's building a case, but he's also trying to build in hope. I mean, he's saying very clearly inflation's going up, but it'll come down. And most starkly, I was struck by what he said about real wages growth in this terms of Parliament. Mm. I mean, to me, that is very courageous, Minister, to be making that kind of prediction.
Well, it was a big election promise, though.
Well, yeah, but he's sticking to it. So he's saying what that means is he's saying inflation's going to come down enough and wages are going to grow enough. Hello, they haven't grown for a while, you know, to put people in the black, which
at the same time as unemployment is rising.
I'm just wondering if that promise, which is, you know, making very strongly at the moment, might come back to bite him in the same way as former boss, you know, Wayne Swan always regretted saying we will get surpluses.
Well, I guess it's such a fundamental part of their campaign. Everything's going up except your wages.
Yeah, but so, real wages growth. I mean, you could fudge that a bit. You could have said wages will go up. But
that's the same thing if inflation's rising higher than your wages. But I assume he's got some sort of long-range forecast. You know, the Treasury's probably telling him, look, by an 18 months' time, inflation should be back to around 3 or 4. And unemployment is so low, it's 3.5, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You'd have to think at some stage that generates some wage pressure. So
we've been waiting.
Yeah, I know.
More people are going to come in.
But they're clearly relying on that, right? So, he's made the call. He's going to have to follow it through. But the other reason he's saying it too, Fran, I suspect, is because as inflation rises, it's going to spark this clamour of wage cases. And he said that last week. He said, look, we can't keep chasing this inflation with wage hikes. And he said on Friday, it's going to go to 7 or so, but then it's going to come down. So don't chase 7.
He's going to say it again today, in the Parliament.
You're going to wipe out business. Yeah.
Look, before we bid you farewell, I think it's important that we talk about what's happening next in terms of the Prime Minister's agenda. He'll be making his way to Garma, and that is, for those who don't know, in the Northern Territory in Arnhem Land, a huge Indigenous festival, the biggest in the country. What biggest thinkers go, prime ministers go, the Olnu present kind of their ideas about the way that they want their culture, language respected. And the Prime Minister's going and he'll be delivering a very significant speech on the Saturday. He, of course, is committed to constitutional recognition in the form of a voice to Parliament. This is a really pivotal moment because they're trying to build momentum around getting work done here. I wonder what your thoughts are about how they're progressing on this, Phil, and the government trying to put some. I know that, for instance, ministers have told me they've been told, we don't want you talking about anything else on Friday and over the weekend. Mm. This is an Indigenous focus because we need to build, you know, the case for change.
The approach is really good, and I like the way Albanese's taken control of it. I mean, yep. How many times have we had this promise about constitutional recognition? Julia Gillard, remember, was going to happen, then Abbott promised, and it all got too hard.
Constitutional.
That's where it started.
It all got too hard. You know, then Turnbull said, so it needs to be driven by the Prime Minister.
And he's doing it at every point, isn't he?
They made it a central part of the Governor-General's speech on Tuesday opening. Mm-hmm. And Albanese talks about it at every occasion. You can tell it actually means a lot to him to get this done. And we know how hard it is to get referendums up in this country. You know, it's just they so often fail. So he hasn't just flicked it to his minister to drive the process. He's driving this himself and bringing the imprimatur of his office to it. So that's a good thing. I mean, it's the most harmless, well-meaning thing in the world is to do this. I mean, I don't often state a personal opinion, but just for the life of me, I can't see why you'd
sort
have...
Sort of like, if not now, when, isn't
and
it,
And
really?
Why not, you know?
It's actually
such a good gesture.
It's also quite a, I believe, I'm going to say it because I've watched it so closely, it is a really modest demand.
Yeah, it's nothing.
It's modest. Yeah.
I think that's interesting how Albanese and others all talk about it as a very generous demand, and I love
that. Some people think overly generous. No, it's very, very nice.
I love that. I think it's very, exactly, it's very generous of the First Australians to say, we want to have a voice, part of the Parliament, to help you make better laws for us, and that's...
They could have gone a lot tougher.
I
noticed the other day when they had the Welcome to Country, Peter Dutton sort of didn't mention it or talk about it. I mean, he said all the right things, but you know, remember he boycotted the apology, for which something he subsequently regretted and explained why he did it. But yeah, there will be Conservatives rattling in his ear, not to back this voice. So, but I mean, if he were to bring his support to it, then that would maximise its chances.
But we haven't quite heard that yet, have we?
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the next, you know... Well, Albanese will outline on Saturday. I think the timing, is it, Patricia? He's going to give us the referendum
I don't
timing.
Know all of the announcements, yeah. So I'm not going to pretend people will hear it. But, yeah, there'll be... Mm. They're not settling yet on it. They want to do it in this term. They're going to be careful on timing, actually. Yeah. But there is some procedural things that they need to do. I know that Julian Lisa will be at Garma. Mm. Now, he's the shadow minister. Mm. That's important, obviously. But he needs to get his own team on side. You mentioned Tony Abbott addressing them the other day. He came on RM Breakfast not that long ago. I asked him about this and he ran the no case lines. Now he's certainly still influential in the party among Conservatives.
But he was Mr. Indigenous.
He was. He was the minister. He made himself the minister for Indigenous.
I think it's fair to say that he said that, but there wasn't a lot of action.
Yeah, but, you know, we can have practical and spiritual reconciliation. Remember John Howard's deathbed confession in 2007 when he realised, I've been wrong all these years. I went down the dead alley
or something.
Yeah, and Peter Hartshaw called it a deathbed confession when he was appealing for votes. But, yeah, you can do both. It's not a binary thing. And we saw how much the apology meant to Indigenous people after years and years of sort of this meaningless opposition to it.
Yeah.
And all these scares around it. It happened. It was a wonderful moment, apart from Brendan Nelson's speech that day. But it was, and it didn't hurt anyone, and it just did good. So, you know, I'd just get it done, would be my view.
Yeah, well, I do think it's, I agree with you. I think it's really important and really noticeable how Anthony Albanese is using his prime ministership at every moment to make this point and to basically... entreat us all to come on the journey. That speech you gave to the new politicians at the start of the week, you know, don't sit on the porch with regrets. Yeah. Basically, be on the side of the angels.
Yeah. At the same time, he's got to make sure he doesn't lose focus on the cost of living too.
Exactly.
Because that's what people want.
It's fun being Prime Minister. Quite a bit on for you too. Thanks, Phil, for coming on the Party Room.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
See you, Phil.
We'll move to questions without notice. We'll give the call to the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
Order.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. And there's a real question time now too, but ours is, of course. There's nothing like ours. No, Dorothy Dix is here, Fran. This week's question comes from Luke, who says, between the controversial Election Day asylum seeker boat statement, the attempted cover-up of the shocking environmental report and his absence from Parliament to reportedly make a paid speech, although can I just add there, we haven't confirmed that, but yes, this is what the question says, is Scott Morrison in danger of trashing his legacy and ending up a diminished political figure, or is this just all par of the course for an ex-Prime Minister?
Well, I don't I don't think it's necessarily par for the course for an ex-Prime Minister. I'm actually struck by how many people are saying to me, what about Scott Morrison not being in Parliament? We can't just not turn up for work. People really don't like that. And it's striking a similar sort of chord, I think, as the, you know, being away in Hawaii and not holding a hose, mate. So I think it's just going to entrench that kind of sentiment, which is already there. And all the focus groups, we've been talking about this for months during the election campaign, showed that that was a real sense of Scott Morrison. And that presumably explains why the then government got voted out so holus bolus, really, at the last election. In terms of the other things, I mean, generally, I think Scott Morrison's legacy will be felt in the fact that they lost so much of their base at this election, that so many of those heartland seats, those blue ribbon Liberal seats in Melbourne, in Sydney, even across in Perth in the Cedar Curtain, went to the Teal Independents in particular and to some others. I think that will be the legacy, really. That will be the thing that trashed Scott Morrison's legacy. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the bigger issues are the thing. But yeah, well, it was just a bad look that entrenched a view about him. And
what do you think about him not being here in the first sitting week back?
Well, it's not a mistake. I've made that a question and theme of my interviews, because I think it's really, really poor form for somebody who's just been elected into a seat not to turn up. There's other ways to doing it.
I understand it's hard. It's tough when you've been the leader to go sit on the back bench and you have to deal with that moment. But that moment's going to come anyway, right?
Sure. Paul Keating resigned, never returned to the Parliament, caused a by-election. I think people, they cost money, it's annoying, but people expect that might happen. We expect that this former Prime Minister will call at some point it quits and call a by-election, but at this stage he's still taking the public funding of being the member that he is. And I think that point about I can't miss a shift and the big wage that, you know, politicians get compared to people on the minimum wage, I think it's galling, to be honest, and I think people see it that way. I think there's many people who have been defending it, including in his own party. They're not defending it. They're not quite rebuking him because they're being careful, but they are, no one's a great fan of what he's done, Fran.
Thanks for your questions. Keep sending them in. We love getting them, as you can tell. PK particularly loves this bit of the podcast. I do too, of course. You can tweet using the hashtag #ThePartyRoom or email your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And you can follow us on the ABC Listen Up. Never miss an episode, and we are certainly back and roaring to go with the Parliament back. That's it for The Party Room this week.
We are here, but we're off. See you, PK.
See you, Fran.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.